This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
This week, November is for neuroscience.
We're learning of neurogenesis is not something that is a static mechanism that occurs through one simple mechanism, but is highly regulated by experience.
Coming up, neuronal birth, thought-controlled robots, and other highlights from the Society for Neuroscience Conference. Hi, I'm Andrea Garleski, and this is The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. In news this week, we looked at views regarding the value of race-based medicine. The findings of an African-American-only trial for a hypertension drug came out this month, showing that the beta blocker nabivolol has a significant benefit on patients' blood pressure. Elijah Saunders at the University of Maryland School of Medicine led the study. Since beta blockers are typically considered poor therapy for African-American patients, the study was praised for taking a careful look at this population. But others were concerned that dividing patients by race for medical studies gives the impression that race is a genetic characteristic, and doing so overlooks the real causes of health disparities among different racial groups. You can read the full article on our website, thescientist.com. Next up, progress in some of the most exciting lines of neuroscience research. In The Scientist this month, we feature a number of different lines of neuroscience research, the molecular machinery of hearing, the parallels between diabetes and Alzheimer's, and a profile of a brain bank in Croatia. Also this month, the scientist Carrie Grenz went to the Society for Neuroscience's annual conference that was held in San Diego. And she's here in the studio with me to tell me about some of the cutting-edge research she learned about.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I know that neuroscience is a huge conference. Give me some stats this year.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely enormous. That's always the first thing that people say about it. This year, actually, I think was smaller than others. It was about 31,000 people. That's what I heard. And I think in previous years, it had gone up to maybe 36 or something like that. But in total, of the presentations, including posters and talks and everything, there were 16,000 different items.
Wow. So how do you navigate all that?
It's not easy. I was actually talking with people about how they go about targeting what to look at, because you certainly can't do it all. Some people just kind of stick to their fields, and other people try to look for collaborators in different disciplines. And then there's also the random approach, which is kind of what I took this year. I sort of roamed through the aisles of posters and tried to find where the crowds were, and so mm-hmm. figured I would just kind of jump on the bandwagon of excitement and look at what posters and talks were getting the crowds.
So where were the crowds this year?
A number of different places. There was a big crowd at some computational studies. Gilles Laurent at Caltech, some posters out of his lab, definitely had at least a dozen people around each of them at any given time. He also gave a talk one day that got a pretty good turnout. He was describing work that he's done over the past few years, modeling networks of neurons that process odors. So he's trying to figure out how the system goes from a large number of receptors that detect the odors, and then they converge upon the glomeruli, and then diverge again in the cortex. So he's trying to figure out this system. He called it like a bow tie shape of, large number of neurons going down to smaller number that converge, and then back out again. And how does that work? And it seems like what he's finding is that it's various combinations of which cells are firing at any given time that allow the brain to accurately interpret odors.
Hmm.
It was really neat.
That's
a little
cool.
A little difficult to follow at times because I don't have much of a computational background, but I think it's definitely worth tracking in the coming years to see what comes out of his lab.
That sounds really cool. How much of his work is also done in animals, or is it all computational on the computer side?
Oh no, he actually does some electrophysiology work.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Some insect antenna lobe.
Interesting. Anything else cool going on there?
Yeah, definitely. There were some posters that got a lot of crowds. It was part of a session called the Brain-Machine Interface. These are the people who are trying to design implants or other devices that can allow people with spinal cord injuries or amputated limbs to develop control of moving robotic arms. So if you remember a couple of years ago, there's that quadriplegic man who was able to play the video game Pong because of an implant in his brain.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So this pretty much the same thing.
There was a press conference about work like that, right?
Yeah, so they have at the neuroscience conference, they do have a number of different press conferences that I attended, and I was able to get tape from them. So we can listen to some of the researchers. One that I found really interesting was by a graduate student at the University of Chicago. His name is Dennis Takach, and he's in Nicholas Hatsopoulos' lab. And he's working on one of the problems in the brain-machine interface, which is if you are trying to map an area of the brain that's involved in performing a certain motor task, like moving a joystick to play a video game, it's difficult if a person can't move his arms to begin with. So this graduate student is trying to find ways to get around this problem.
That's cool. Let's play some of the tape you got from that press conference.
Okay, this is Takach, and he's talking about getting a monkey to operate a robotic arm that will move a cursor. And the monkey is doing this all with his thoughts.
But the problem, specific problem I was alluding to, is that in order to make a movement, in order to replace movement in the brain-machine interface, you have to have that movement, that behavior present, and neural activity. You can see a human patient here plugged in. The problem is when you have a quadriplegic patient, what do you do? There's no actual behavior that they can do that you can relate to the neural activity they're recording. Well, as our research has shown, there are numerous properties of neural activity that are present during actual behavior in an intact subject. When you show a video of this behavior back to the subject, in our case a monkey, so that cartoon that you saw, the cursor running around the screen, when the monkey watches that and we look at the characteristics of neural activity, certain characteristics of neural activity, they are very similar, if not same, with the way neural activity behaves when the monkey actually plays this game. So what the conclusion we draw from our work is that a possible solution to this problem when you don't have a behavior is that you can replace the behavior with a video of that behavior, and that will allow you to create a mapping between the neural activity and the behavior you want to replace.
Well, that's very cool. I also read on one of your blogs that Newt Gingrich spoke at the conference. How was his talk?
Yeah, I had never heard him speak before in person. He didn't say anything really surprising. For a while now, he's been a strong advocate for biomedical research funding. So a lot of his talk was, you know, cheering for neuroscience and funding it, and really urging scientists in the audience to bug their representatives and Congress people to give more funding to the field. But I guess I was kind of surprised at what a good speaker he was. He was actually really funny, and he would crack a lot of jokes at his own expense. So it was pretty entertaining.
So he was the entertainment of the conference.
Yeah.
Great. And so what else was there in terms of research that seemed really exciting or cutting edge that you noticed?
Yeah, well, one of the talks that was definitely just spilling out into the hallways was by Clive Svensson at the University of Wisconsin. He was talking about using growth factors to protect dying neurons. There's also a press conference about neurogenesis, which is something that I've covered a little bit. And so in this press conference, they were looking at the ways that neurogenesis is regulated. Neurogenesis is the growth of new neurons in adult brains. So the factors that might regulate it, of course, there's all of the molecular factors, but environmental ones like disease and stress and diet.
Great. Well, you told me that you taped some of that press conference, so let's hear a bit from the researchers on their studies.
Sure. This first one here is from Tariq Pereira. He's at Columbia University. He was following up on some rodent studies from a few years back that found that neurogenesis is essential for antidepressants to be effective. And he wanted to see if the same was true in primates.
Okay, let's hear about what he found.
When you block neurogenesis, antidepressant lost its effectiveness, and the animals became depressed or anhedonic. This was also true when you look at the social hierarchy. Under control conditions, there was no change, but under stress, the animals without treatment became more subordinate, animals with treatment became showed an increase in hierarchical standings, and that increase was blocked if you gave irradiation. When we look at neurogenesis, so what we see is that antidepressants increase neurogenesis. These are two methods of looking at neurogenesis, but let's focus on this. Antidepressants increase neurogenesis whether or not you're stressed. So this is a solid line, no stress, this is stress. Stress does not seem to decrease neurogenesis below normal levels. So this is normal neurogenesis, this is with stress. When you block neurogenesis, this is what we show with irradiation, what we can do is we can block antidepressants from increasing neurogenesis. So when you put all this together, what do we see, the results of our studies? First of all, the chronic stress can produce behavioral abnormalities that may resemble certain features of depression. These behaviors are not associated with decreased neurogenesis. Antidepressant treatment seems to improve or prevent the production of depressive symptoms in monkeys. And they also stimulate neurogenesis, but they do it whether or not you're under stress. Blocking neurogenesis seems to abolish the therapeutic effects of antidepressants. So what this shows is a cause and effect between the stimulation of neurogenesis and the therapeutic effectiveness of antidepressants.
So what Pereira is saying there is that neurogenesis is necessary for antidepressants, something that people had found in other animals. But then after him at this press conference, Sebastian Collard-Dupré at the University of Regensburg in Germany presented data about how much antidepressants stimulate neurogenesis in different age groups.
Okay, let's listen to what he has to say.
All right.
And what we could observe in the different groups of age is that the group that received the antidepressant treatment didn't show any difference in proliferation compared to the group that received a placebo, and this no matter what age group we looked at. In contrast, when we look at the survival and at the neuronal differentiation, maturation, and integration, we could see that in the youngest group, in the 100 days old animal, that we had an increase in the net neurogenesis, and this was due to increased survival and increased neuronal maturation. But in the two older age group, the 400 days and the 200 days and the 400 days, we could not see this increase in net neurogenesis. So from these data, we conclude that since fluoxetine can be effectively used in the clinic to treat depression, no matter what age group it is, we conclude that the fluoxetine antidepressant activity on the neurogenesis is not necessary for its antidepressant action.
Wow, so what do you make of this? It sounds like they're saying two different things, right?
So yeah, so what he's saying is that when you give Prozac to these older animals, they don't have the same survival of new neurons or increase in survival of new neurons that younger animals with the treatment do. So he says that it might not be necessary for the therapeutic benefits.
So that's interesting because we wrote, we ran a feature in July on the trouble with animal models and how various factors in animal life, age, weight, sex, can all really influence your experiment results. And I wonder if maybe there's some of that going on here, especially because you're seeing two different results regarding the same kind of study.
Right, so why does it make sense that you might not need it in animals, but you might need it in humans? It's really not clear. I didn't get a chance to speak with them afterward. There is a company out there, actually, that I've written about that might help us answer that question because they're testing a drug that they say, you know, they're looking for drugs that rely on neurogenesis for their antidepressant effects. So it'd be interesting to see if neurogenesis is sufficient, not just necessary, but if it's enough for an antidepressant to work.
That's the company you profiled?
That's right. They're called Brain Cells, Inc. They're in California, and that was in April.
That's a very interesting development in this story. Thanks for the update on the meeting.
You're welcome.
That was the scientist Carrie Grenz giving us the highlights from the Society for Neuroscience meeting earlier this month. You can read her blogs from the meeting and all of our neuroscience coverage in the November issue at thescientist.com. That's all for the Scientist podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.